everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Angela, and I am with the podcast Refocus with Angela Stevens. I am so delighted to introduce you to our guest today. You are going to find that she has so many tips and advice for productivity and getting your life in order. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. So please help me welcome Geraldine Markle. She's a PhD and a board-certified executive coach. She enhances leadership and workplace productivity. She's the principal of Managing Your Mind Coaching and Seminars. She's written books and she has so much advice. So again, thank you, Geraldine, for joining us today.
Oh, it's just a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to it.
Wonderful. So did I get your title right? You've done so many things and I want to make sure that I cover it, and we will do that. But you've written many books as well. So I just want to make sure I got all of that in one sentence.
Right.
Okay.
I've always been extremely practical. So the first book I wrote was Defeating the Eight Demons of Distraction. Having a research background in ADD, I was doing consulting and nobody wanted to know about ADD. So I looked at the distractions people had in the workforce and came up with a catchy title of Eight Demons. And so I have a lot of strategies.
I love that. So tell me, when you mentioned that, you said that you had started in ADD when it was, you know, not as popular. When was that? How long ago was that?
Well, I started out as a teacher and a reading consultant, high school reading consultant, and then went to graduate school and was on the faculty at the University of Michigan School of Education. And I always did research on attention, reading, focus, achievement. And for many years, there was no medication. We were all strategies. And it was at a time where nobody really believed it was real. In addition, prior to people like Ned Hollowell and Rady and Sari Solden, nobody thought of adults with ADHD or ADD. And so as the field progressed, medication became available. And what became clear is that medication allows the pause and the focus and the patience to use the research-based strategies that have evolved over the last 20, 30, 40 years. So I think we're at a great time and place for people with ADHD to get control of their productivity, whether it's at work or at home.
I could not agree more. As many of our listeners know, my son was diagnosed with ADHD when he was in the fifth grade, and I was 45 when I was diagnosed. And I remember even 10 years ago, there was a stigma about giving medication. And I always say that it's a process. It's a whole package. You have to look at what works for you, what works for your child, or even your colleagues, and giving them advice. So I commend you. And I feel like we've walked down the same path together.
Yeah. There's a special group. I call them gifted with a glitch. These are people who have high intellectual potential and ADHD or some other learning disability. And frequently, that is the least recognized group, because it's unbelievable, whether it's parents or teachers, people in the workforce, that somebody could be border on brilliant, but be disorganized and forgetful and really scattered. So that's a very special group that's important to recognize, that even if you're smart, you can have these challenges that at some point start to become a real barrier.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because when I look back, even into my own personal life, I was so busy raising my son, it did not occur to me that I could possibly have ADHD or be diagnosed with it. And when I was younger, we did not have those resources. So, you know, we made do, but looking at his life and the things that he suffered with and had challenges with, I can see my own childhood through him in a way.
Right.
So I agree with you. I think we've come a long way and I think we're still going. But I wanted to ask you, when you said about the book, for anyone that hasn't read it, I'm sure it's still available, but Actions Against Distractions, what was it when you first started? I'm very interested on what were some of the distractions that you found that were really disruptive in individuals' lives?
Well, for a person with ADHD, the primary one may be an unruly mind, where they have intrusive thoughts or they're scattered and jump from one thing to another. Perhaps they have poor executive function, so they can't really deal with time or space. But other ones that I identified were other people, you know, interruptions, technology, fatigue. When people are tired, they can't muster the energy to manage themselves. Stress was another one. And medications or illness. So all of these can impinge upon a person's ability to manage themselves. But when you have a couple of them, you have the additive negative effect. So if a person has ADHD and a scattered mind and a poor memory, the more tired and stressed they are, the more they are in a situation where there are external distractions, sights and sounds and whatever, the less they're going to be able to focus. So if a person's lucky, they find a medication that sits well with them and can use the medication plus the strategies. It is a step-by-step way to understand your style. One of the very important parts of working with a person with ADHD is to ensure that they get a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation, because that shows cognitively their strengths and weaknesses. And so a person could be quite brilliant when it comes to vocabulary and analogies, but, you know, spatial relationships or their memory or their rate of working may be slower. And unless you have good data, it's very hard to understand and then get into control of your daily performance. So that's one thing that I always stress, to find somebody who can do a good comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation.
And you know what? It's interesting. You and I were thinking at the same time, the same comment, because I was going to say, if you are a listener and you're struggling with ADHD and maybe the medication's not working and you're talking with your physician and it's not, they're not understanding you, or if they're not listening, it's okay to find a new physician to, you know, find out what works for you. And I think sometimes people are afraid to leave their current physician, right. But there's so many out there that might offer benefits to you that you might not even be aware of.
Right.
And so with that comment, I want to answer that question for our listeners. When you said that they should get a neuropsychological assessment, who would someone go to for something like that? If someone's out there that may not know who to go to, what type of doctor would they go to for that?
The first step is often their general doctor or a psychologist who identifies that they have a number of symptoms, and then maybe a psychiatrist who would see and a clinical psychologist to see not only if there's ADHD, but the handmaidens, the comorbid things like depression or anxiety that are so common. And then from there, they would recommend a neuropsychologist, somebody who not only has a PhD in psychology, but has had a fellowship, and so is an expert in testing and putting in the time. A lot of these tests take 4 to 6 hours. And to see exactly what are some of the pieces, like, you know, what is your memory like compared to how fast you learn something, compared to how your spatial relationships are versus, you know, how you can formulate and do judgment or have vocabulary. So our mind is a wonderful, wonderful tool, but we want to make sure that we understand what's in our toolbox. And so when you know your strengths and you're aware and accept your vulnerabilities, you can feel comfortable in saying, this is a tedious, horrible task. I hate doing it, but I need to do it. I'm going to do it when I'm alert. I'm going to do it only for 15, 20 minutes at a time, and I'm going to set myself up so I'm not distracted, and maybe I've just got to sort of do some relaxing things before to get back into neutral, and then I'm going to get in high gear by making a specific time, having a small goal, having the resources I need, and maybe put a timer on so I only work for 20 minutes.
So question about that. What time is a good time for someone who may be distracted to take on the most difficult projects? What time of the day usually is a good time for individuals to do something like that?
It all depends on the individuals. There are some people, they're not musicians staying up all night doing jazz, but they have a hard time sleeping. And so, you know, for college students, many of them go to sleep too late. But even when they get up, they're groggy. They're in a fog. So they take classes at 11. But there are other people who can get up early, and that's where their peak attention is. Other people have a peak attention later in the afternoon or in the evening. So if you ask a person, they know when they're on and when they're off and when it's the best time to do a difficult task. For people who have a high interest in a particular task, they may get positively hyper-focused and work on that for an hour or so. Otherwise, sometimes it's negative hyper-focus and they'll work on it for 4 hours and eventually their performance sort of deteriorates because they can't, you know, you can't be working in high gear for that long.
Correct. You know, one of the best investments I ever made personally was hiring a business coach for myself, because when I was running three businesses, still am, but when I was starting to do that, you know, things were piling up. And I remember specifically this certain business coach said to me, he said, you know, you've got to find out what time of the day works best for you. And then those are your peak times. And I don't think until that moment, I really took a step back to figure out what that time is. So I would encourage anyone that's listening to this to really pay attention to when you get your best work done and to really monitor that, because then you'll find your productivity is already, you know, starting to get it. It's going to get better.
Right. Right.
So I have so many questions for you, Geraldine. I think I could talk to you for all day long. And when all of you who are listening to this find out some of the companies she's worked with, you'll be blown away. But I want to go back to the beginning of your career. When you said that you worked as a teacher and you went into education, first of all, what grades did you teach?
I started out in middle school. And then taught high school, was a consultant for reading, and then was a college professor.
Got it. So because of your background, with today's situation and a lot of parents that are having to teach at home, what advice, if you had any advice, which I'm sure you could give a lot, but if you had a few pieces of advice to parents who are trying to teach students who may have a problem with being distracted, you know, what are some tips for them?
Tip number one is that you've got to tame the technology. So the phone has to be off, and there are things on a computer. There's one app called Cold Turkey that you can stop access to the internet. Number two would be that throughout the day, there are at least 10-minute breaks, two or three times a day, where students have a gross motor stretch or, you know, sit-ups, maybe dancing, a time to cool down, listen to some soft music, have an app like Calm or Headspace, and learn deep breathing so that they always have a way of self-soothing to get back to neutral so that they can then focus again. This idea of having class after class, or in business, meeting after meeting, 60 minutes or 90 minutes, back to back, there's no transition time. There's no way to reorganize and refocus and rest. So I think parents have to help students and teachers feel comfortable taking those mini breaks and then altering difficult with easier subjects.
Right. That's fantastic advice. I met a woman the other day who was teaching her, she had three children and she was teaching them at home. And she gave me a really cool comment. I wanted to pass along on this. I asked her the same question and she said, I'll tell you about students in a minute, but she said, for me as a parent, it's important that I take those breaks, because if I don't take those breaks, my students or my children feel it. And that's the first time I've heard a parent say that. And I thought, wow, you know, that's really, you know, something that we don't hear. We hear a lot about the students, but we really don't hear about, hey, you know, you've got to take a moment. You've got to take that cool down, because parents can get frustrated, right? When they're working with children, when they're not used to doing that 8 hours a day.
Right. So the parent can take a break with the child or children so that everybody lays down on the floor with a pillow, listens to some soft music, stretches. And once parents model that kind of behavior, it's generally emulated by children. So if the parent is running around all day, why wouldn't the children try and do the same thing?
Right. Absolutely. So, okay. So you started out as a teacher, and then you moved into this profession. What was it that made you say, okay, I don't want to do teaching anymore, and I want to go into this profession? What was it that made that career change for you? As many know, I'm a recruiter as well, and I always am fascinated with everyone's journey.
Part of my training was in clinical psych. And when I was in a small room with a person with significant mental impairments, I decided that that was not for me. I'm too gregarious. I like to move around. And I'm a problem solver. So being an educational psychologist, my job is to help people learn strategies, and then they can help themselves. So I become the supportive element, the facilitator, the accountability person, and so on and so forth. So being a consultant in business or a coach gave me that opportunity. So that's
right. How I got. That's beautiful. I love that. It's interesting because I feel like I'm at home. I feel like I've a lot of the same people that we talk to have a lot of many different but similar transitions. And I love that take on life, because I always say, even if you're 50 or 60, it's never too late. You can always learn something new, whether you make that change or just do it as a hobby. We're always able to make, you know, a change in our life.
Perfect.
Right. So as my mother always said, she used to have this one thing I told her that she's going to be known for. And if I ever showed frustration in my life, she looked at me and she said, take a class. And that was her advice. And I did it. And it would always take me on a road to something new that I would be working on. So I so valued that advice from her. So moving forward to the listeners of this podcast, Geraldine has worked with such companies as the Ford Motor Company. She's worked with Disney Corporation. She's worked in the agricultural area. She's worked with Viacom, Time Warner, Merrill Lynch, the University of Michigan. I could go on and on and on. So one of my big questions when I saw this was, what is it in today's world that these companies have reached out to you that said, we need help in this area? What is that area?
I think it's a combination of really wanting higher productivity, at the same time having greater satisfaction. So that productivity alone is empty and it's not sustaining over the long haul. But if you pair productivity with strategies to reduce your stress and really find satisfaction, then you have a long-term way of maintaining good performance and then taking on the challenge of constantly being a new learner. Because we don't have a choice now. Times are changing and you have to learn all the time to be a great professional.
Got it. So this question is before the pandemic. So these companies ask you to come in and talk, you know, with their teams. What is the feedback that you hear from the employees? What do they struggle with?
I think employees in general have a big struggle if they're working under a particular supervisor who does not give enough or clear or specific feedback. So productivity really depends on people knowing what to do, how to do it, when they need to have it done, what the resources are, and how they can, you know, modify whatever they need to do. and many, many people in a supervisory or leadership position do not depend on having regular meetings and communicating to people as people. And it's quite cut and dry, or there's only an annual review, and people flounder because they don't know what the standards are, or the standards are so unattainable that they really, they don't feel like initiating new things.
Right. And I read a study recently about a company that had done research on their employees when the pandemic started. And I think it was in the first 6 months. And they said the productivity had drastically reduced. And I'm sure, have you heard the same thing?
I've heard it in two different ways. That in some cases it's reduced, but in other cases it's enhanced.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That I was going to say, because what I've heard is the same thing, but then after everyone kind of got used to it, they enjoyed it. They appreciated the flexibility. And so now I'm talking with CEOs who say there's got to be more of a flexibility approach to coming back.
Yes. I don't think offices will be filled ever the way they were.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a recruiter, the one thing that I have given advice to some department heads and CEOs is that, you know, at this point, there's a lot of candidates who say, you know, I like working remotely and I don't want to go back in the office. And so how do you retain those employees at that point? And I always say, if they're really great employees, you've got to figure out a way to bridge that, to come up maybe with a flexible pattern, maybe 3 days in, 2 days at home, right, or something like that. And if they've proven that they do their job well, you know, that's half the battle. Because when, you know, before the pandemic, if anyone worked remotely, from years of experience in this area, I know that many were not cut out to work from home. You know, they were doing laundry, they were watching TV, right? So that was like a process in learning. And so I think it's really interesting how everyone had to learn that overnight, pretty much.
Right.
And
to be regulated.
Exactly. So what happens, I'm curious. So what happens when you are, you know, working with these companies and you have maybe several individuals that maybe are not coming up, you know, to the level of productivity that the company really needs them to be at? Do they bring you back, or do they have you work one-on-one with the individual? What does a company do in that situation?
Usually it's one-on-one. So if I'm doing a seminar on stress versus productivity, say, then part of the package is an opening if people would like to elect to have X number of coaching sessions. And maybe a coaching session with part of a team so that you get into what are positive and productive feedback kinds of things to do. You know, it's very difficult to have everybody working remotely. If you have a certain package or product to get out, that's one thing. But if you need sustainability, initiative, vision, then you need collaboration and you need opportunity for unintentional meetings and spontaneity. So we're going to have to find ways to be flexible and have some kind of blending, especially if a company is one, a startup, or two, looking for real growth, because you can't have growth without vision, collaboration, and communication.
Excellent. So again, like I said, I think I could talk to you all day about that, but I want to take this back about you again. So when a company brings you in, you're doing the seminar, I'm sure, you know, everybody has bad days, right? Or they're off, or they're tired, or they're not focused. You know, how do you, if you have one of those days, if you have, and you are having to do maybe a full day session, something like that, how do you focus and get it together in front of, you know, of a large team, or in front of a board, or in front of a company, and talk when you're not really there? How do you pull it together?
Well, part of my background is my father was a jazz musician who was with big bands and worked at the Radio City Music Hall. And there is no option that you don't feel good when you're a performer. The show goes on. And so part of having the confidence to go on is really a lot of practice. So whatever topic I'm doing, I spend a lot of time, one, making the content so easy to understand and appealing and visual, and then two, practicing it so that I'm really comfortable. And if 60% at least of our communication skills are nonverbal, I make sure that I have a flow, that, you know, I'm not twiddling my fingers or pulling my hair or something like that. So practicing and little parts at a time make you much more comfortable. And in terms of getting yourself ready for the show, it's going back to what's my value? Why am I doing this? You know, do the people in the audience care if I'm having a bad day? I don't think so. So I use all my senses to, you know, maybe I'll even chew gum evergreen. I'll stretch. I'll take some deep breaths. I'll visualize a time that I did a great job. In the back of my computer, I have pictures of family and friends and events. And so I look at those and say, okay, you've done it before. Now it's your turn to do it again. And so I just am my own champion. But I use visualization and self-talk and all the behavioral cognitive strategies that I might teach somebody else because they work.
I love that. I just wrote that down. The show goes on, because I was a theater major as well as a marketing major, but I just had to throw that in there because I was really drawn by that comment, because you're right. And I always say, when people are getting ready to speak, they've asked you to be there for a reason. You know, they know that you know what you're doing. They know that you're good. So, you know, I always say, when people question themselves, remember that, because in those moments, you've got to be your biggest supporter.
Yeah. And my father owned a music store in Midtown Manhattan, and the customer was always right. His focus was always on the customer. And he was a person who only had a sixth grade education, but I would see him on the couch and he'd be talking to himself. I'd go, Danny, what are you talking about? So I'm just remembering each of the people who were in the store and what I did and how I could do something better the next day.
How awesome to have a father that did that for a career in Manhattan. What a fun life I hope that was for you, because that sounds really, really great. I bet you met a lot of great people.
I did.
Who was the most exciting person that you ever met?
Well, one that I knew very well was Sonny Rollins, the saxophone player. He and my father were fast friends. Woody Allen used to go to my father's store for reeds because he played the clarinet. And after he became very, very, very famous, he sent his father in. And my father would say to Woody Allen, Woody, it's the Indian, not the arrow. Breathe from your diaphragm. So, you know, you just learned in a store like that and living in New York that people are people, and you treat everybody as if they were the most famous person in the world, because to, as your customer, that's who they are.
And absolutely. In my search for I always say, look, today's CEO is tomorrow's janitor and vice versa. And everybody's human, and you treat everyone with kindness. That's right. That's in all of our mission statements. And we're a big believer of that. So with that being said, who inspires you?
I think my family inspired me, because like so many people, I was the first person to go to college. This was not on either side. Nobody really had a lot of schooling, but they worked hard. And for example, my mother-in-law was 90. She was still selling advertising specialties. So everybody in the family really worked hard, and they paid attention and they listened to what was going on. So they were inventive in their own ways. But nothing takes the place of time on task when you're really paying attention and thinking, how does this task relate to the bigger picture? Where do I want to go and why?
Got it. A lot of people will write to us and they say, I think one of our most requested questions is about failure. And I think sometimes people forget that everyone fails at some time in their life. Has there been a point in your life where you failed at something and come back?
probably the most significant, horrible, tragic experience was my son dying because he had a ski accident. And then after 18 months, he passed away.
Oh, wow.
And that absolutely takes you and the family, throws them up in the air, and who knows who's coming down there. So I think knowing that you cannot work for a while, that you must spend time allowing your body and your mind to grieve, was very important. And also, as coping as I am and as positive as I am, I knew I needed something a little different, a little deeper to help me. Because no matter who you are, you sort of blame yourself and could you have done this and why did this happen and so on and so forth. So I knew somebody who did EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization, where you're just getting a person with their senses to relax at a little bit deeper level and talk about the message they want to give to them, such as I did the best I could. And so that reaching out to other professionals, because I knew I couldn't, this was something I couldn't do alone. So we went to grieving groups. We did everything people talk about. We did journaling. We met with people because I knew that unless I did these things, I wasn't going to be able to focus. And it did work because I did have extreme productivity, you know, for, you know, the 10 years after. But I did have to admit that this was a game changer and that I couldn't do it alone.
Wow. That's, yeah, that's incredible. I think people have heard me talk about this on the show before. But I was 16 and we lost my sister who was 10. Wow. And I had a teacher, and I love teachers for this part, because I remember one day I was sitting in class, and I just had a tear rolling down my eye, and I don't know what that day was. And she just said, Angela, can you go out in the hall and do something for me? And she wrote me a note and just said, take some time. And I will never forget that piece of kindness. So, and as an educator, you can understand that those teachers, sure, they make a difference in your whole life. Right. So that was great advice. And I want to ask you about that really quickly, about with people who are going through such a difficult time right now with COVID and the pandemic. For those individuals who've lost family members, which is horrific, and they are having difficulty going back to work and getting back to being focused, any piece of advice for those individuals?
I think there's two big things. One is reaching in and looking at what your inner strengths are and practicing time, giving yourself time to grieve, to get through it, not get over it. The second thing would be reaching out to feel a sense of community, to talk to other people with similar losses, how people are doing, not being able to say goodbye, not touching, not hugging. So it's especially difficult. And I think it's going to be a little bit more long lasting than we're thinking of. So I think as communities, we have to look and reach out to people who we think might have a problem. And you just take a chance and you call or write a note. Say, I don't know if you want to talk, but I'm here for you. And I just want you to know we're thinking of you. People often don't call or write because they don't know what to say. But you don't have, right, to say anything. You can get a sticker.
Right. No, I, you know, I absolutely agree. We have two guided anxiety journals that are coming out with our company, Refocus the Creative Office. And that's one of the things that I mentioned is the bravest thing you can do is reach out to somebody and just say, can I talk for a few minutes? So you and I are telepathic today, I think, or something. So we're spot on. So that's really terrific. And you're the first person that I've asked that question to. So thank you for answering that and giving advice, because I know many people really, especially individuals who don't have the support of a family or close friends, I know that they will graciously appreciate that. I did want to ask you, so, and I'm going to let you talk about this. So to all of our listeners, she's got some fantastic books that she's written, and I assume they're all available now, but can you tell us your newest one and which ones you have out now and where they can find them?
My newest one is Actions Against Distractions. The Defeating Demons talked about the various demons, but in the Actions Against Distractions, it really is a guide so that in general, there are a variety of good tools and strategies such as positive visualization, productive self-talk, using your logic, just separating your logic from your emotions, stop, look, and listen, just stop for a minute, look within yourself and visualize a scene that you want to do, and then give yourself some positive instructions. And it's a guide by guide, looking at the kinds of challenges you might have, and not only what's the first thing you do, but what do you do and how do you keep track of behavior? Because I spent so much time observing behavior and learning about it. So when people begin to become aware of the fact that they need a timer to remind them to stop working at X time so they have a time not to be bombarded by digital stuff, and that they need some time to quiet down before sleeping. So very practical kinds of things, but everything is research-based. And things are available on my site, www.managingyourmind.com, in the productivity section. I'd like to mention that I offer a complimentary coaching session, 20 minutes, that you can sign up on that site too, or sign up for my newsletter.
Oh, that's terrific. I know many will be excited. And one of the books that you've highlighted that just really caught my eye was Finding Happiness. I loved that title with Aristotle, but I loved Finding Happiness. I thought that was great. So, but again, you know, Geraldine, you are terrific. Who, if anyone wants to meet with you, again, you have the complimentary 20 minutes. Do you do virtual counseling as well and coaching?
Right now, everything is remote. So okay. I'm doing seminars for schools, colleges, and corporations on productivity and work life stress and so on and so forth. I do a lot of academic coaching for college students or people who are in school as adults or finishing their dissertations, or high school students who are learning about their ADHD. I might tell them the same thing from a research base that their parents are saying, but you know, they don't perceive me as the nag.
Yeah. Right. And you're, yeah, exactly. No, I got our son a coach, and best money I ever spent, again, because again, I don't want to be on him all the time. I wanted him to do well. And I figured that somebody else, he would listen probably more to them at that time in our life. And he's in college now. So, but what I'll say to our listeners is this, is that Geraldine, I had a chance to meet her, talk with her before this podcast. She's so easy to talk to. She has so much wisdom, so much knowledge that I really encourage you to check out her site, take her up on that 20 minutes of counseling. I think it'll be a significant enlightenment in your life. So I would definitely do that. So Geraldine, we have one major question that we ask everyone at the end of the show, and it's probably one of everyone's favorite. But if you are really needing to focus, and it's one of those days, again, that it's just you're not on, but you've got to really have game on that day, and you get in your car and you're going to that meeting, what is the music or the artist or the genre that you listen to that gets you up, that gets you going and gets you focused for that meeting?
I have to say that the song would be in my head, and it's called The Sunny Side of the Street. It's from the 30s. Because it talks about get your hat and get your coat and leave your worries on the doorstep, get on that sunny side of the street, and that you used to have the blues. And I'm all about strategies of how you can move from an unproductive few minutes to a productive couple of minutes. So that kind of song reminds me of not only the old days when my father and mother were living through the Depression and so on and so forth, but it reminds me of all the research.
Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear that pitter-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street.
The other thing I listen to often is the Michigan Marching Band, because, man, if that doesn't get you moving and
wow,
and ready to walk, nothing.
I'm going to make a confession here. So when I was in high school, I was a cheerleader, but I was also a twirler, and I twirled fire, and we twirled fire on that football field, and they don't even do that anymore. And now I'm really aging myself, but I got to tell you, those were some of the best memories of my life. And there's nothing like a football game. There's nothing like that excitement. And so a marching band is awesome. And going back to my mother, when we were growing up, there was no question. You were going to be in the band. You didn't have a choice. You could pick any instrument, but you were going to. And that, she put the love of music in my life. And so I think that's why I love that question in all of our interviews. So, Geraldine, first of all, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been such a delight for me to ask you many of these questions and to provide all of these resources and insight to our listeners. And we graciously appreciate your time.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. And you're still being a cheerleader for all the people that you help. So
thank you.
Really been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Bye-bye.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Refocus the Creative Office. They create all of their products through the eyes of a child with ADHD. They create products that help you focus and refocus. Do you ever forget your passwords? I forget my passwords all the time. They have over 11 versions of password books. They've got large, they've got mini, they've got left-handed versions, and they just came out with two brand new camouflage versions in green and pink. Hopefully these products are going to help you focus and make your life better. Have a great week.